Of 552 students in the entire school, 520 of them were there on a full ride scholarship. I mean, the question is, who is paying tuition at Campbell University School of Law? Hello and welcome to episode 451 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. I'm Nathan Fox. With me is Ben Olson. We're the co-founders of LSATdemon.com and the LSAT Demon Daily podcast. You can be LSAT famous, share news, and ask questions on our website, thinkinglsat.com. We have one LSAT registration deadline that we need to be aware of right now, April 23rd. This podcast is going to air on the 22nd. So, if you're listening to this podcast on launch day, you've got today to decide whether you want to register for that June 2024 LSAT. Ben, how do students know whether they're ready to take the test in June if they have to sign up on April 23rd?
If you like your practice test scores, then sign up. If you don't, wait.
And what if I'm in the gray area?
I would say wait.
What if I'm in the gray area, but games is my best section?
Then sign up. You can always withdraw before if you need to, and it won't count against you. You're basically paying $200 to preserve that option, or what, $222 now to preserve that option.
Yep. And it's an unfortunate example of the rich getting richer. Not hard to find examples of those in the world, of course, but it's just one of these things where if you're from a wealthier background, you can afford to just go ahead and register for that test and have it as an option to take it. We see like wealthier students do that without even really thinking about it. And meanwhile, the poorer students are like, oh man, 6 weeks ahead of time, I have to decide whether I'm going to be ready to take this test. And it's $222 and I got to be really sure. Don't know if there's anything we can do to fix that problem.
Yeah, I mean, the one thing about it is, although you have the opportunity to pay money to preserve that option, psychologically, right, people fall into this trap of, oh, I've signed up for it.
True.
Now I should take it. I should take it even though I don't need to take it. And so there's a bias, right, toward taking it, even if your practice test scores don't get up to where they should be to take it. So you really have to see it as an option, not as a requirement.
Yeah, and meanwhile, your dad, who doesn't know shit, but, you know, still shares his opinions on every matter, is going to say like, oh, well, you know, you're just see how you do. Just you're already signed up. Just go ahead and take it. See how you do.
Yeah. Stop procrastinating this and come on, get going.
Just do it. You know, then you'll know how it goes. And then and of course, that means I'm mocking dads everywhere. That's just really bad advice. Like you have a limited number of times that you can take this test and you can see how it's likely to go by your practice test scores. Mm-hmm. So if you're happy with your practice tests, then yeah, sure. Take the test or sign up for the test. If you're close 4 or 5 points and if games is your best section and the June LSAT 2024 is the last test with games. So I can see how there might be a small incentive there for people to push it for that June test.
Yeah, there's going to be an options bump, right? A number of people keeping that option open is probably going to increase.
Yeah, we would think it's good time to be the law school admission council because they're going to rake in a lot of $222 that are going to just turn out to be withdrawals and they get money for free. But just be careful taking your folks' advice and your friends and family and all that. You know, they don't really know this game. And so them pushing you into a test that you're not ready for, it just doesn't do anybody any favors. All right. New U.S. News Law School rankings are out, Ben, and we have written a blog post that covers the big winners and losers. You want to talk about this a little bit?
Yeah, so the title of our article is U.S. News Law School Rankings 2024 to 2025, Big Changes in T100. Now, when I saw this and I knew it was our article, I was like, oh boy, we're making it sound important. Thankfully, the title of the second paragraph is, does this matter?
Yeah. And then we go into why it should not dictate your school choice and how the rankings are determined And anyway, you know, it's a clickbaity kind of a thing. It's once a year these new rankings come out. And so we've got this post. The headlines, I guess, Catholic University of America somehow jumped 28 spots.
Yep.
My alma mater, UC Law San Francisco, formerly UC Hastings, dropped 22 spots in the rankings. Law school deans do get hired and fired based on results like that. So we'll see what happens at these particular schools. Does it make too much of a difference, Ben, that UCLA is back in the top 14 and Georgetown is now back out of the top 14? Does that really matter at UCLA?
No, it doesn't matter, because when you matriculate at either of those schools, you have no idea what ranking it's actually going to be by the end. And I mean, there's one, there's not a difference between those rankings. And two, there's no guarantee that they're going to be that when you graduate, let alone 10 years after you graduate. So it's just not something you can or should worry about. The one thing I do think that's interesting is that Harvard persists to be number four. And I think of all the schools, you know, people have for years talked about Harvard, Yale, and Stanford being this almost like this trinity of untouchable schools. And even among those three, it almost feels like Harvard has just more of a name that carries itself beyond law and in ways that maybe even Yale and Stanford don't. Yet it's still number four, and Yale, Stanford, and Chicago remain in the top three, with Yale and Stanford at the top in number one. So,
yeah, I mean, it's kind of a farce, right? Like, on what planet are Stanford, Yale, and Chicago measurably better schools than Harvard Law School? I just don't think that that's like really reflects reality very much. But that is,
yeah,
in the rankings.
I don't know. I don't know what to make of it. Yeah. I mean, I do like looking at numbers, because I love how numbers can make you rethink your perceptions, right? So to the extent that the U.S. News rankings tells us anything about the world, I'm not saying that it does or that the rankings are useful, but to the extent that they're trying to gather hard data and then quantify those, it can make you say, have our perceptions of Harvard been misleading? Because really the outcomes that people have when they leave Harvard aren't as great as we've assumed or that they're perceived to be. It's hard for me to believe that that's not the case, but what is it about the numbers that's causing these things to fluctuate?
Yeah.
I would at least want to know, right?
Yeah. The other thing to keep in mind is just that these ratings do fluctuate wildly over time. I mean, they don't move as much in the top 14 or in the top five, you know, what, T6. They don't move as, although, do you see what they did? There's now a 1-2-3-4-way tie for fourth place. So Harvard was actually ranked fifth last year.
Yeah.
But now it climbs a spot, Duke climbs a spot, and UVA climbs four spots. So now those are all tied for fourth.
It's unsatisfying, right, to not have these schools broken down and to give each one their own rank. But at the same time, this probably better reflects reality, to the extent that reality is reflected here at all. It's much more likely that these schools are, what, indistinguishable, right?
Yeah, right. That you can't actually tell really any difference between these schools at that level. I think that that's probably correct. I also would just say that, you know, the name of Harvard as a brand of lasting value. U.S. news rankings fluctuate a lot. Harvard's brand name, you know, if you separate it from the law school rankings, if you ask people who know nothing to name the best law schools in the country,
yep,
they're probably going to say
Harvard first, even before Yale,
right?
And Stanford.
Well, yeah. I mean, and to make it even more stupid, I've even had people in the test prep industry, okay, SAT type of folks, right? People who tutor like younger kids, but very successful, like expensive private tutors. And I had one guy who for years would keep asking me what the ranking was of Princeton Law School.
Oh, interesting. Yeah.
Which doesn't exist. There is no Princeton Law School. But if you ask like Joe Schmo on the street, you know, name the most famous law schools or what are the best law schools in the country? Yeah. I think you're right, Ben, that Harvard is going to be one of the very first things that comes out of their mouth. But Princeton might also be. And that doesn't even exist. And it's not even a thing. So I don't know what I'm saying. The rankings are really pretty dumb. We break down exactly why. Go check out this blog post if you want to see the winners and losers in the top 100.
Yep.
Next one is, these are two questions that are related. So why don't you read both of them? First one is from Julie and the second one is from Alex.
Okay. Julie writes, "Hi, Ben and Nathan. The deadline for law school decisions is coming up. So my guess is that a lot of your listeners and followers are grappling with similar questions about how to decide on the best law school for them. Personally, I'm deciding between Northwestern with about an 80% tuition scholarship, which turns out to be $60,000 per year, with tuition at $74,000 per year, or Harvard, which offered me no money. Full tuition is about $77,000 per year." Okay, so debating between Northwestern and Harvard. I'd love to hear your opinions. Would you take the lower T14 with a significant scholarship or the prestige slash name and full price tag of Harvard? Thanks for getting me through the LSAT. I appreciate your consideration. Alex writes, "How much should starting salary determine where I matriculate? I'm deciding where to matriculate thanks to 2.5 years with the Demon. Wow. I have scholarship offers of 68% or more at Minnesota, Madison, is that Marquette, and ASU. Per ILRG.com, I'm not sure what that website is, but looking at it briefly, it's called Public Legal. I guess it has information on law firms and so forth. According to that website, their average starting salaries as of 2019 were $112,000, $71,000, $56,000, and $82,000 respectively.
So that's $112,000 at Minnesota, $71,000 at Madison, $56,000 at Marquette, $82,000 at ASU.
Okay. And that kind of follows their ranking. Marquette is the lowest ranked school and has the lowest average starting salary. Anyways, Alex continues, "How much should I let this determine my decision of where to matriculate? Thanks, Alex."
I appreciate Alex's email. I think, Alex, you got to dig in quite a bit deeper here. You're doing some surface level calculations that I think need to be taken a bit more seriously. The average starting salaries, that's really a misleading metric, because average, you know, that's like the arithmetic mean. That's just going to be add up all the salaries of everybody in the graduating class and divide by the number of people, and it's going to just be heavily skewed by the people who are going into big law. So Alex, do you want to go into big law or do you not want to go into big law? If you want to go into big law, then you need to be thinking about big law placement at each of these schools and not thinking at all about the starting salary, because the starting salary of big law is its own separate beast. These average numbers, Alex, are almost useless. I mean, I think all it's really doing is reflecting big law placement. I mean, looking at if the average starting salary at Minnesota is $112,000, but the average starting salary at Marquette is only $56,000, that makes me think that half of Minnesota is going into big law and 5% of Marquette is going into big law.
Exactly. These numbers don't exist in the real world.
Right.
Instead, they're just metrics that reflect the likelihood maybe of getting into big law. The higher the number, maybe more likely, because a greater percentage of that class is going into big law. Of course, you have to consider the fact that where are you going to be in that class?
Yeah. The other thing I don't like that Alex did was summarized it down to a percentage scholarship offer. I don't care what the percentage is.
True.
I care how fictional the tuition is at these actual schools. And, you know, paying one third of the tuition at these schools, I don't know, it may or may not be a good deal. I'm looking at Marquette right off the bat. Marquette gives 1% of the class full tuition. It gives 35% of the class, yeah, something more than half tuition. Then it gives a ton of people a scammership, and 15% pay full tuition. So, you know, if you're only paying if you're paying one third at Marquette, you're in the top one third of their offers. And that doesn't seem terrible. Flip all the way to the other end of that. Minnesota is the highest ranked school. Pretty much same deal there. Minnesota gives full rides to just 2%, and then they give something more than 50% scholarship to a little north of half of their class. So they give lots of those kinds of scholarships at Minnesota. At least last year they did. You know, you're getting the better half of their offers at that school. That's not that bad.
Yeah,
it's so also not that good.
It's not that good. So what you're saying is Alex is looking at, is almost accepting the price, the nominal price that these schools are
right.
posting as if they have any meaning. It's like, oh, well, I'm getting 68% of that.
Yeah.
No, the question is, how much do you have to pay to attend there?
Yeah. It's looking like these schools, well, okay, so at least Marquette and Minnesota don't offer huge portions of their class full rides. But, you know, ASU, okay, so ASU, 3% of the class is getting full ride plus stipend last year. 9% of the class is getting a full ride. So now you're looking at a school where 12% of the class is paying zero. Now, you know, like that offer doesn't look as good at Arizona as it looks, assuming you got the same offer everywhere, which also feels kind of weird because these schools are not.
Well,
really...
it's 68 of tuition or more. So then, are some of these schools almost free?
Yeah. Okay. I just think maybe for Alex, we don't have enough. We don't really have enough information here to determine, Alex. You need to look at the price you're actually going to pay. You need to think about what you want to do with your JD. You know, if you're in it for a lot of money, then you need to go somewhere where you're going to have a good chance of getting big law placement. That doesn't mean that you necessarily have to go to a higher ranked school, because you can be a big fish in a smaller pond and get the big law opportunities that a school like Marquette, such as they even exist, you might be able to get those offers at Marquette. You might be able to get those opportunities because it'll be easier for you to compete on grades. The other thing that strikes me as kind of strange about Alex's email, Minnesota, we know where that is. That's in Minnesota. Madison,
Wisconsin.
That's in Wisconsin.
Yep.
Marquette, also in Wisconsin. And ASU.
So this sounds like a situation where Alex used the estimator to find schools that would give him a good deal and applied. Maybe.
Okay. To just those four schools?
Well, we don't know all the schools that he applied to. He might have applied to several more, and these are the only ones that gave him scholarship offers.
None of those offers sound super great to me. I don't think, like, if I had made it all the way, you know, IGLAD, investigate, figure out whether this is something you really want to do or not. G for GPA, get your grades in the right spot. L, get your LSAT in the right spot. Then apply. And then D is decide. So Alex is all the way down at the decide phase. These offers don't seem super fantastic. I guess without knowing more about what Alex really wants, you know, because Alex is just specifically asking us about money.
Mm-hmm.
But what do you really want, Alex? What do you want to do? And also, where do you think you want to live? Because that is kind of strange to have Minnesota, Wisconsin, Wisconsin, Arizona. And I wonder if maybe Alex didn't apply quite broadly enough to get more of these kinds of offers, including full ride offers. If you're really worried about the money, then I think a full ride is like sort of the first thing that you would be looking at.
Yeah. Well, I think this is really like a lesson for all listeners writing in about tuition / scholarship / acceptance questions. We really want to know, what's it going to cost you to go?
Yeah.
Because when you say 68% of tuition or more, like maybe Alex has a stipend at ASU. dramatically different than 68% at Minnesota. But yeah, we don't know.
If this is a stipend at ASU, then it's a, yeah, then I can give totally different advice. I just know that you're doing the wrong thing by looking at average salaries. Average salaries are almost meaningless, or except all that they really do is they just reflect what the big law placement is. But if Alex has no interest in being in big law, then that does nothing for him. Mm-hmm. And if he has 100% interest in big law, then he should be thinking about big law placement, not thinking about what the average salary is coming out of that school, because all that's going to reflect like, okay, how many people go to this school and then practice something else.
Yep, exactly.
But that doesn't really affect Alex, because if you want to go into big law and they have big law placement, then that's the clear path for you. So,
and then by big law, by big law placement specifically, you mean, okay, what percentage of the graduating class tends to go into big law? Is it 30%? Is it 60%? Something crazy like that. And then, or 10% or 5%. And then you ask yourself, okay, given how well, or given how high my scholarship is at this school, how likely am I to get into that top 20%? Because, I mean, it's not a given that the top 10% is going to be the one that's going to big law, but it's a safer assumption, right? Can I get into that top 20%?
And if you wanted to, you could. Yeah. If you get the top 10% of grades, then you're going to be able to get big law interviews. Mm-hmm. From that at that school, if you want them. But sometimes people go into prestigious, you know, federal clerkships and that kind of thing instead because they want to be a do-gooder. They don't want to go into big law. Okay, fine. That's a decision that you can make. When you have the good grades, you get to decide.
Yeah.
But the grades are going to be pretty necessary for getting into big law, probably at all of these schools. Like, I don't think Minnesota is a good enough school that you can finish in the bottom of their class and still waltz into big law. I doubt it. Yeah. I mean, that's why the starting salary is only $112,000 at Minnesota. Just they're big law. It's really just big law placement. I think the thing everybody misses, it's a bimodal distribution of starting salaries for lawyers. Most lawyers, most people, if you're going to go be a public defender or work in a small firm, most of those lawyers are going to make $60,000, something like that, 65. Starting salary. And if you're going to go into big law, it's more like 200. So averaging out the 200s and the 65s gives you these fictional numbers that are in the middle. Well, I guess Marquette's number is not even in the middle of that. 56,000 at Marquette. There's just not a lot of people practicing big law out of Marquette.
Exactly.
All right. Anyway, let's talk about Julie.
Yeah. So when I think about Julie's situation, I think about a population graph. You know how it shows for centuries, it's essentially flat. And then in the last century, the population just spikes.
Okay.
So I imagine that the value you get out of law school is similar to that graph. Most law schools are on that flat line, but there are a few schools at the very end that the value maybe spikes up. Yeah. For example, Harvard, Yale, Stanford, because the value of being able to say, hey, I graduated from Harvard Law School is going to just affect your entire career. It's going to affect your starting job. It's going to affect jobs in the future. You're just a Harvard law grad. It's not to say that the value continues forever. As people progress in their career, their law school becomes less and less important. But Harvard is one of those schools that is going to be a part of your identity for the rest of your life in a way that I just don't think Northwestern is. I'm not
even
saying
though,
that. Yeah.
You know, Northwestern is ranked 9th in the country, according to
it's
the New
excellent
US
law
News.
School. Excellent law school. Yeah.
It is a super excellent law school. But yeah, it's not Harvard.
It's not Harvard. So I imagine this graph is going up, right? And it spikes at the end. And I think Harvard is much further up on that spike than Northwestern. Northwestern is still up the curve. It's way better than so many schools behind it. But I think this is a question where, it depends on what you want to do. I think there are certain opportunities that Harvard will allow you to pursue after law school that Northwestern won't. But if all you're interested in is big law, then heck, look at Northwestern's big law placement that we were just talking about. And realize that, hey, I can go into Big Lot and have almost no debt or very little debt, just a win, right? Financially.
Also, you know, I would consider, how do you feel about Chicago?
Mm, sure. Versus Boston.
Chicago is its own, like, you know, New York City in Illinois. And so if you are a Chicago person, if you're a Midwesterner and you like being in Chicago, then there's maybe reasons to be in Northwestern instead of going to Boston. You know, on the other hand, if you're an East Coast person, maybe you would just rather stay on the East Coast. Last thing I would point out here, well, a couple things, actually. Harvard doesn't offer merit-based scholarship, but they do give a lot of need-based scholarships. And so you might want to try to investigate that a little bit, depending, Julie, what kind of circumstances you're coming from. It's possible that you would end up paying zero at Harvard because of their need-based aid.
Wow, that'd be crazy. Yeah, but certainly possible. Even just some off, right? Then you're not comparing full tuition to whatever, you're comparing half tuition.
Right. So if you could find out more about that, you know, like, and maybe if you have too much money, or you've got a spouse who makes too much money, or your parents, whatever, there's reasons why you might get disqualified from that merit-based aid. But if not, and you might qualify for that merit-based aid, yeah, that would be really nice to find out.
I would ask, though, right? Because a lot of people assume that their salary is too high sometimes. And it's like, actually, you know, $100,000 a year might not be too high.
Not what it used to be.
Yeah.
Right. Right. So, yeah, there sometimes people do get pleasantly surprised on that. I also just want to encourage people. I want to remind you that even Harvard is not a golden ticket, because you might hate it. And I got a stressed phone call few weeks ago from a former student who was at Harvard and not loving it. And think about what happens if you're on, like, if you're paying full price for that and you're at Harvard and you don't love it. And this is, by the way, somebody who never got anything but straight A's for their whole life. All signs pointed to yes. You know, no reason to think that this was not going to be just a continuation of the great success that they had in undergrad. But then they get there and they realize that it's just not what they thought it was going to be. For whatever reason, they find that they're stressed out. I think this might happen more to people coming from warm weather places, going to cold weather places, by the way. if you're from a warm weather state and you're considering these two schools, you might want to think about winter. Because it's real, you know, speaking as someone who grew up in California and then lived in Boston for a while, it's like, man, that you could give yourself depression by doing that. And I think that might happen sometimes. I mean, 1L's already stressful enough, right?
Yeah.
So just think
now
about
you gotta bundle up and just not freeze on the way to class and come home. Yeah.
You know, people at this level, they've always been successful, right? So they tend to sort of see the successful paths. But yeah. It is possible that, like, family shit could happen to you, personal shit could happen to you. Not everybody at Harvard is, like, loving being at Harvard. So it's not like, oh, it's just, you know, it's going to be a dream.
Yeah, it's just all downhill from there.
Paying for. Yeah. I don't really know about that, because, like, it's possible that you don't graduate.
Yeah.
And you're still going to owe all that money.
Yep. Whereas if you went to Northwestern, you'd owe a lot less given the tuition difference.
A lot less. You're only paying $14,000 a year at Northwestern instead of paying $77,000 just in tuition at Harvard.
Yeah. So bottom line is, you really got to figure out what Harvard is actually going to charge you.
That's one thing that, I think would be really useful.
So you can compare these and then decide, like, how much risk do you want to take? The other thing I want to clarify here, and this is not so much for Julie as for just everyone else listening to this discussion, we're talking about a school that's offering 80% tuition scholarship, really $14,000 per year or $77,000 per year. The only reason we're having this conversation is because it's Harvard or potentially, you know, Stanford or Yale. If we were comparing a school that was five rankings different anywhere else, and these were the different prices, it would be a no-brainer. You'd go to Northwestern.
Oh, for sure. Yeah, for sure. And I don't know. I think people need to be careful about like letting their ego get involved. Mm-hmm. You know, I remember when I was deciding, but you know, it was a totally different level, but I was deciding between Hastings, which at the time was ranked like 40th. Now they're ranked like 80th, by the way.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's just a decade. You know, I graduated in 2011, and in the decade, the ranking has more than doubled, like,
yeah,
which is bad.
Yeah.
So that can happen to law schools, and you need to consider that. Anyway, I was deciding between the Bay Area schools, not Berkeley, because I didn't even apply because I don't have the grades for it. But I was deciding between Hastings and the other San Francisco schools. And I remember somebody in class, one of my LSAT students, telling me, yeah, I just think that you're more of like a Hastings sort of a person. And
yeah, and you took it. You went with it.
I totally did. It's a joke at my own expense because I just remember, going like, yeah, they're right.
Yeah.
I am kind of a Hastings sort of a person.
Yeah.
And so Julie, I hope you're not sitting there going like, well, maybe I am more of a Harvard type of a person. Cause probably that's what your folks are telling you. Your friends are telling you, you know, yeah. There's a lot of reasons why people are going to make that bad ego based decision at the last minute, instead of buying, you know, instead of, paying the right price for, for a professional certification, which is going to get you to the next step of your professional career. What do you want to do? Has Northwestern made their pitch to you to like tell you exactly how they're going to get you what you want?
Mm.
Do you know what you want, Julie?
Yeah.
You know, lay it all out to Northwestern. Tell them you're in at Harvard. Tell them you're worried, you know, that you're turning down opportunity, like you're going to close doors by not going to Harvard. See what they say.
Yep.
They might come back with a better scholarship offer.
They might. You don't ask for it explicitly.
You don't have to ask them about it at all. You're only asking them about the opportunities, and they might come back with like, oh, you know what? Actually, we have a president's special whatever.
Someone just declined an offer, and we
let me
just
hold on
opened
a second.
Up. Yeah.
I want to go talk to my manager in the back. I think that there's some specials that have just came down from corporate.
Yeah.
You never know. You never know. I would notice also, Julie says the deadline is coming up.
Mm.
Yeah, maybe it is. But school doesn't start until end of August.
Yep.
So, you know, it's not like this cycle has been slow. So you can always ask for extensions, tell them you're not sure. Tell them you have some concerns. I don't know. You don't have to just like blindly follow every little rule that they set out for you.
Yep, totally.
You know how the Airbnb tells you to take out the trash before you leave?
Mm.
That's on their list of rules, but you don't have like, trust me, I've stayed in a lot of Airbnbs and I always get 5 stars because I don't tear the place up.
Yeah.
But you don't have to do all of the things that they've got all those things on their checklist. Like, hey, maybe the person will just follow this checklist.
Yeah.
But they're not really actually expecting you to like do that kind of work before you check out of the place. I don't know. Okay.
Yeah.
Tyler writes in. Tyler says, how should I cope after blundering on my first official attempt? Tyler has a 169 practice test average. Not bad. And he's normally perfect on the games. He just took the April LSAT. And Tyler says, I was feeling confident at the break because the first half, reading comp and logical reasoning, had gone so well. But then I blundered. I misread the first rule of the first game and didn't notice for 5 minutes. Naturally, this threw me out of my rhythm. I got to the final game with just 3 minutes remaining instead of the usual 8 to 10 minutes. I couldn't set it up, and I guessed one letter for the entire thing. There were 6 questions on that game. Despite that, I forged ahead, and I feel good about the fourth section, which was reading comp. So you had 2 reading comps, so one of those doesn't count. Waiting to see the score, but I plan to retake in June. In the meantime, how do I overcome feeling shitty about this attempt?
This is why we plan on taking the test at least twice and potentially up to five times. How many people get up to bat and hit a home run? How many people get up to bat and even hit, right? The first pitch? No, you take multiple chances so that you can really get it right. If a pitch wasn't good enough for you, you wait.
Yeah, in this case, Tyler fouled it off.
Yep. So what? That's part of the game.
Right. That's strike one. And on the LSAT, you get five strikes. So, yeah. You know, you got to just take another hack. Tyler's mistake here is really useful for people to learn from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Tyler, you like fucked up your Saturday, right? You fucked up your April LSAT in 5 seconds. You got to games. Games is your best section. You're excited. You know, things are going really well for you. Oh, no problem. I'm going to knock the games out of the park. Feel great about this. You blundered by misreading that first rule. Maybe you further blundered in that next 5 minutes, because if you're good enough at the games, I think you would have discovered that mistake earlier.
Yeah, like the first question, and you...
Well, Tyler maybe didn't even get to the first question, right? Because Tyler's still working on worlds or whatever, working on some setup, and it's just like not, the things are not falling into place.
Mm.
Maybe you could have caught it a little bit quicker, Tyler, but, you know, your real mistake was just misreading it in the first place. And so even though games is your best section, even though you're normally crushing it, it's like safety first. You have to, even if you're just going to the corner store, you have to put on your seatbelt. And, you know, I think Tyler just didn't take that moment to make sure that he was reading everything properly in the rules. Next thing you know, you burn 5 minutes and it destroys your whole section. I mean, you could say, oh, it's only six questions, but if you've got a 169 average, those six questions, you know, it's the difference between a 173 and a 167. I don't think you need to feel shitty about it, though.
No.
Chalk it up to experience. Keep doing everything the way you've been doing it. Keep working on your practice tests. Keep reviewing all your mistakes. Take the test again in June. Plan on taking it again in August. If you've got one backup for your first test, then you need another backup for your second test. So take it again and again if necessary, and again if necessary. But plan on, now you got to plan on June and August at a minimum.
Yeah, I just want to say a couple more things for Tyler in case it's not obvious. And that is, one, Tyler, this was your first attempt. That's a huge win. Some people blunder their fifth attempt or their fourth attempt, and then they feel the pressure, right? So that's great. Apparently, you're great at RC and LR. So who cares that June is the last time with games? You can keep going in August. Some people are stressing because games is their strongest section by far. So you got that in your favor. You can learn from this experience. Some people are going to have to hear this message from you and still make this mistake. I don't know. A lot of things going for you. That's all.
Thanks, Tyler. Next one is from Hawthorne. Why don't you read it, Ben?
Hi, guys. I'm an LSAT Demon subscriber, and I'm curious whether you think the August curve will be affected by students who are putting off sitting for the test until logic games are removed. No. Personally, my score jumped by 7 or 8 points automatically with the new format, and as you said, many others sitting for it in August are waiting to receive the same boost. What do you think? I had considered waiting for October for this reason, but I think I may sit for both since October is my last chance for early decision. Okay, whoa. Absolutely. If you're ready for the test, take it in August and in October. If you need to take it in October, do not wait or skip August because of this perceived boost. There's so many misunderstandings here. Do you want to start?
Well, the test isn't curved. the test is scaled. They've determined based on the difficulty of the questions that they have previously tested on earlier tests via the experimental section. Like, you know how Tyler had two sections of reading comp? One of those didn't count. One of those was the experimental section. They're gauging the difficulty. They're comparing Tyler's RC that counts to Tyler's RC that doesn't count. And then they're seeing, oh, he scored similarly. Okay, so this one is similar difficulty. Oh, he scored worse. It's harder. He scored better. Oh, it's easier. And then they determine based on that, they set the scale. So it doesn't matter if it was nothing but me, Ben, all of our teachers at LSAT Demon, and all of the, and that's all that was taking the test in August. It wouldn't matter because the test is scaled. It's previously determined. The only thing that matters is your performance, not everybody else's performance. So that we can just let go of entirely.
Yep.
Anything else?
No, just this, like, then weighing that over. I mean, now that hopefully that's gone, Hawthorne won't give up an opportunity to take a test when Hawthorne is ready.
Yeah, if you're going to be ready, then you should take it in August and October. Wait, is the calendar out for the fall?
I think it is, yeah.
Oh, okay. That must be relatively recent that that all came out, that they, because previously the dates were only scheduled through August.
Yeah.
Anyway, there's usually a test in, you know, out of September, October, November, December, there's usually tests 3 of those months, probably 2 at least, maybe 3.
Mm-hmm.
So you have plenty of opportunities to retake it in the fall. But yeah, don't skip August if you're ready. Is there anything else for Hawthorne?
Oh, yeah. There's a September test.
Yeah, right. So that's why I didn't think October made any sense. So plan on August and September. Is there even an October test?
There is an October test. And a November
and there's
test.
An October test. Oh, and November. Yeah. Geez, okay. So you've got a bunch of months in a row there that you can take tests if you want.
Yep.
Last chance for early decision.
Oh, I totally skipped over that. We never recommend early decision. It never makes sense. All you're doing is giving up your leverage.
Yeah. To be clear, we recommend that you do your own early decision program. And what that means is you apply early in the cycle, broadly, with the best LSAT you can muster. And if that means you're not ready this fall to apply, you just apply next fall. Early in the cycle, broadly, with your best LSAT, and then you do an early decision program of your own.
With the schools, yeah.
And by the early decision, I don't mean that you actually decide early, because you have to be patient and wait until May to make your decision. But you apply early and broadly, and then you let them start bidding for you if they do. And if they don't, that's fine. That's their decision. But if they bid for you early, then now you can start investigating the school and maybe negotiating your scholarships. We do not recommend Hawthorne. Whatever early decision program you're looking at any particular school, you really got to read the fine print on that. Because if it's easier to get in, it means that they're not going to give you a scholarship. And if it's not easier to get in, then what's the point of early decision? So there's really no value in any of these early decision programs, at least not ones that we have seen. They seem to be heavily weighted to benefit the school, not to benefit the applicant. This goes double for junior deferral programs and programs that give some incentive to their own undergrads. Those deals always benefit the school and never benefit the student, not in our experience.
Yeah, and the way you just talked about this, I think, is important. I think people probably picked up on it, but just in case they didn't, notice how the phrase early decision focuses the discussion and the negotiation on what the school is going to decide. We want to we don't care what the school decides, because it's with or without you. We're you know, if you don't want to pick us, fine, because we have tons of other schools that we've applied to and that we're looking forward to getting offers from. So we really want to focus on our decision, not the school's decision.
Right. Exactly. You got it. I mean, the fact that you even think that a junior deferral program or an early decision program or whatever, the fact that you like think that this might be good for you means that you're already losing the negotiation.
Yeah.
Like you've anchored on this idea that you might not be good enough for this school.
Yep. And if only they could choose you.
Yeah, pick me. And then it's like, yeah, okay, we'll pick you. And you'll have to pay full price.
Yeah.
Which is the worst possible outcome. It's much better to just get denied. Okay. Anonymous. Oh, go ahead. You got something more for Hawthorne?
No. I was just going to say the next person's anonymous. And the subject is 3 hours a day to study.
Says, hi, Ben and Nathan. How would you recommend spending time studying if you have 3 hours to work with every day and you are currently testing in the low 160s? Is it better to focus on one section daily and simply drill, review, and repeat? Or would it be better to split that time evenly between the three sections? Also, would you recommend splitting the time between untimed drilling and timed sections? Or is it more beneficial to focus on drilling slash timed sections on separate days? Thank you so much for your advice. It's helped me immensely as I plan for the June LSAT. I look forward to hearing your thoughts. What do you think, Ben?
Yeah, I think you're over-engineering this, Anonymous. You seem hyper-concerned about, should I do drilling and a time section, or should I just focus solely on one section each day and then shift to another section the next day? I'm going to say that it doesn't matter as long as over the week you're moving through all the sections and you're moving through drilling and time sections. You're not just doing any one of those things. So to the extent that you need guidance, I would say make sure you're doing one section, timed section, every other day or every day, somewhere in that range. And then fill in the rest of your time with drilling as you see fit. And feel free to take a day off if you need to.
And make sure you leave plenty of time for review during all of that. If you do a timed section, that means you also thoroughly review all of the mistakes from that timed section before you do anything else. Anything. Totally. Review. Because review, if you don't review now, it's likely that you're never going to review. And even if you do, you're not going to learn as much from it because it's not as fresh in your head.
100%. You're going to do a question again. You're going to get it right. And you're going to say, I don't know why I got it wrong before. It makes sense now. Okay, great. Well, you get to learn from that experience.
Right. Why is the right answer right? Why is the wrong answer wrong? Why didn't you pick the right answer the first time? Why did you pick the wrong answer the first time? Dig in deep and make sure you're getting the maximum out of your review. That's really the answer to your question, Anonymous, is that you just need to do a little bit every day, mix it up with timed sections, mix it up with drilling, mix it up with games one day, or games for part of it, reading comp for part of it, LR for part of it. It just doesn't matter. That's how you know that we're not lying to you, by the way, is that we are not afraid to give the most unsatisfying answer that a teacher could possibly give, which is it doesn't matter. Mm-hmm. And I know that this makes people pissed because they're like, what do you mean it doesn't matter? I want you to tell me exactly what to do.
I want to be maximally efficient, right?
I know. And it's like, okay, the real answer though to your question is, if you want to be maximally efficient, stop asking questions like that specifically and instead ask a question that's related to a real LSAT question that you struggled with.
Yeah.
Like, this is a waste of time. So I'm not mad at Anonymous for doing
it. No, let's clear this up, right? It's good for people to hear this, but
And I'm not mad at any student who asks me any of these questions, but it's like, I can feel the stress coming off of the email. And it's like, the thing you really need to do is you need to focus more on the substance of the test.
Yep. Doing official questions one at a time if necessary, if that's all you have time for, and then reviewing those questions before moving on. That's it. That's what does matter. You're right. What doesn't matter? Okay, well, what does? That's what matters.
It's like, am I studying correctly? Well, okay, let's see. Checklist. One, are you doing an official LSAT question right now? No? Okay. Two, are you reviewing an official LSAT question right now?
Yeah.
No?
Yeah.
Sorry. If it's no to both, then you're not doing it right.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just like, that's what you need to be doing, is looking at real questions all the time. So we don't recommend that you do like, hey, someone who was lying to you would be like, oh no, just follow this specific program.
Yeah. Have you seen our program?
follow these exact results, you know, just do this exact schedule.
Yeah.
And I did write a thing called 1 hour LSAT a couple of years back. It's a lesson still that lives on in the daemon. And if you just want something to follow, like you can follow that 1 hour LSAT, but all it's telling you is every day I want you to do a mix, different topics, time sections sometimes, drilling sometimes, thorough review of all your mistakes.
Yep.
Do that 6 or 7 days a week. You're going to be successful. Thanks for not writing in, anonymous. Next one is from Emily. Emily is a non-traditional splitter with two low GPAs. Oh, interesting. Oh, she graduated with a 2.98 GPA in a poli-sci major after switching from pre-med. Weird. Then she later pursued a degree in accounting but dropped out with a 2.5.
Wait, how does LSAC deal with a second undergraduate degree?
I believe it's going to be completely disregarded. But why don't you read Emily's email and then we'll talk about it.
Sure. I now work as a family law paralegal, and I know that I want to pursue law school. Is it even worth applying? Is my life and world experience enough with a 159 LSAT to give me a shot at admission? This is my dream, and I'm willing to pay for happiness. Whoa.
Wow. One, money can't buy happiness. Two, if it did, it would not be in the form of a JD.
Yeah.
Three, Emily, let's see. So want to clear up the first issue first, and then we'll look at the scholarship estimator.
Yeah. So my guess is that the 2.5 isn't going to matter. And so that we're going to be dealing with something around a 2.98.
Yeah. I believe that until you have gotten your first bachelor's, you can take other classes in undergrad schools, and they don't even have to be like for your degree. They just, it's like undergrad classes that I took before I got my bachelor's. And I believe that that all counts toward your LSAC GPA. The day you graduate, I think any further bachelor's level work is going to be disregarded when LSAC calculates their UGPA. I think you could probably go on the LSAC website or call LSAC to confirm, but I think that that's the way it's handled.
Yep.
That's what you were going to say too?
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm.
So let's assume then I'm going to go to lsatdaemon.com/scholarships with a 2.98 and a 159. Let's see.
The first full ride I see is at Campbell University, which is ranked 134.
Yep. That's what I'm seeing too. Is that the only one? No, because Appalachian University, possible stipend there. Southern University, possible stipend. Texas Southern, full tuition scholarship. So, you know, long story short, Emily, not only can you get into law school, but you can at certain local law schools, like Campbell seems to be the best one. I mean, if we want to click into Campbell a little bit more, whoa.
What?
Okay. This is a visualization. We're looking at the roll call tool. This is lsatdaemon.com/scholarships, by the way, or lsatdaemon.com/tuition. This is a visualization of Campbell's ABA 509 data, and it's telling me that last year, 94% of their class paid no tuition at all.
What the?
But I'm going to click their 509. This is what we're drawing the data from, if we're doing it right. Emily's 159 puts her at the 75th percentile of Campbell. By the way, this is Raleigh, North Carolina. Not the worst place to live, as I understand it. Her GPA is below their 25th percentile, so she is a splitter. This school last year received 957 applications. They offered 370 of those admission. About half of those said yes. So they had an enrollees from applicant pool of 180. They charge $48,860, resident and non-resident alike, another $1,000 of fees. So it's a $50,000 school that is ranked pretty low, right? It's a local school charging big time prices. And in the grants and scholarships matrix, their report, they reported this out to the world that of 520 students, sorry, of 552 students in the entire school, 520 of them were there on a full ride scholarship. I mean, the question is, who is paying tuition at Campbell University School of Law?
Yeah, so I guess, wait, question one in my mind is this data correct? If it is, how are they sustaining their university?
I wonder if we have any listeners in Raleigh. I wonder if we have anybody familiar with this Campbell University School of Law. We could make the title of this episode, Who Pays Tuition at Campbell University? Sorry. Who Pays Tuition at Campbell University School of Law?
And
I would love to know. Established in 1979, ABA approved, rather, since 1979. But somehow, like, nobody who goes to Campbell is paying scholarships. And they also don't offer any conditional scholarships.
Wow. That's what I was just going to look at next. Okay.
What's it get you is my question. I mean, I really want to, I'm really very curious what, I want to know who pays. Because if you look at the roll call tool, I mean, it's just stark, right? It's a sea of green. There's 5% of the class that's paying something. Less than half tuition they're paying. And then there's this 1% that pays full tuition. It's like the 1% is keeping the lights on for the 94% who pay no tuition at all.
It's like inverted from society. The opposite of society, paying for 1%,
yeah,
paying for
in law
else.
School, the 1%ers are the getting the short end of the stick.
Yeah.
Not in like it is in real life. Yeah,
we might need to set up like a helpline because these six people, whoever they are, when they if they are unaware of the fact that they're paying full tuition, and 99% of the class is paying almost nothing or nothing.
Well, it's like I don't know if there is anything in tort like relief for these people, but it just
yeah
seems
that
like,
seems criminal, right? Like.
It How? Seems criminal.
Yeah.
Yeah. It is questionable. Like do the 1% at Campbell, you said it was six people.
Well, yeah, that's our guess. Yeah.
Well, wait, I'm going to look at the 509. I'll tell you exactly.
No, because it doesn't tell you the number of people who don't. Oh, I see. You're just going to add up. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. There's 552 students. 549 of them are receiving grants.
So
it's actually three people.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
There's three people who are getting no grant at all. There's an additional 29 people who are getting something more than half tuition paid for, but they're still paying tuition. So there's three people who are paying full price. That's the $49,000.
That's just cruel. That's just insanely cruel.
It is wild to think that the three people. So, like, what's their total revenue, Ben? Their total revenue is. Three people paying 50 grand a piece plus another 29 people paying, let's give them the benefit of the doubt and say that those people are only getting a 50% scholarship.
Sure. Okay. Yep.
So to maximize their revenue. So there's 29 times 25,000.
Yeah.
Yeah. 24,000. Let's be generous. 29 times 24,000 plus three times 48,000. Quick math.
Well, I'm just going to do 35 times 24,000.
Okay.
That's 840,000.
So the school is only generating $840,000 in revenue, according to their ABA 509 report.
For 552 people.
Yeah. I mean, they're offering 95 course titles beyond the first year curriculum. I don't see how they keep the lights on. I mean, unless they have separate funding coming from somewhere else, I don't see how this school stays in business.
And what's it trying to do? Because right now it's ranked 132. Is it just maybe it's a 3-year plan? Hey, look, we're not going to make any money. We're going to actually lose money, but we're going to pull ourselves out of the T150 and try to get into the T100 so we can have some respect at our local dinner parties. I don't know.
Could we dig in just a little bit deeper? We were talking about at the top of the show, we were talking about law school rankings changes in the top 100.
Yeah.
But what about the big winners outside of the top 100? Well, it wasn't Campbell, because Samford University climbed 28 spots. University of Maine climbed 26. Gonzaga dropped 21 spots. Louisville dropped 37 places. But how did Campbell's rank change? And we don't have that on our crazy graph either, because it would blow up the graph too much if we included the top 100 school, the next 100 schools after the top 100. I don't know, man. That's a mystery. I would love to know what's going on at Campbell. It also makes me want to look at some of these other schools, because again, with who are we talking to again? I lost it. Emily. In Emily's case, to reset, Emily is a 2.98 GPA, we think, and a 159 LSAT. And on the scholarship estimator, yeah, the best full ride that we see, the first full ride we see is Campbell at 134 with full tuition. Scrolling down, we also see Appalachian offering a full tuition. Now, see, but this makes way more sense. Did you click on Appalachian, Ben?
No. Yeah, I will.
You might want to take a peek. It's a nice get to see all the colors of the rainbow.
Okay. Wait, what are they ranked? I'm having trouble finding it.
180.
Oh, okay. Oh, yeah, there we go. Oh, possible stipend. Oh, wow.
And if you click on the roll call.
Yeah.
Did you get there?
Yeah.
Yeah, so you can see here that 29% of the class last year at Appalachian was getting paid to go there.
Yep.
2% are on full tuition scholarship. 20% are on something more than half tuition scholarship. 29% of the class is paying more than half tuition. And then there's 20% paying full price. So I can see how Appalachian keeps the lights on. You know, there you've got, it's still a bad deal for the 20% of the class that's paying full tuition. That's still a bad deal. But now it's not literally three people. Let's see how big Appalachian actually is. Grants and scholarships, 22-23. Total students, 161. Total receiving grants, 129. Yeah, a bunch of those are on more than full tuition. Could be like a military school or something. Yeah. There are 32 people there who are paying full price. Not just the three at Campbell.
Yeah.
But 32 at Appalachian.
And then another 47 paying less than half. Or I'm sorry, paying more than half.
Another 46 people. So there, now you've got like 100 people that are paying something significant to keep the school running.
Yeah.
That makes a lot more sense. And then, well, a lot of that money also, though, is being transferred. Like, when we look at the blue, if those people are getting stipends to go there, it's like, well, who's paying the blue? The red.
Yeah.
20% of the class is paying full tuition, and 29% are paying zero and actually taking money out. But at least they have a diverse, like, they've got, like, a curve, whereas Campbell was just like, okay, we found three suckers this year. Hope that's enough to not get the building repossessed or whatever.
Yeah.
Crazy.
So wait, what's Emily's question?
Well, is it even worth applying? And I actually do want to address this. I mean, people might be surprised to hear me say, Emily, I think you absolutely should go for this if you do it the right way. You're a family law paralegal. You know that you want to pursue law school. You know what it looks like to practice law. I, I'm hoping that you want to be a family law lawyer. If you don't want to be a family law lawyer, then I want to take back my endorsement of your law school plan. But if you want to be a family law lawyer and you are now a family law paralegal, I believe you.
Yeah, I mean, heck, Emily may be looking at a job opportunity in her very firm, right? And just needs to get to the degree. Yep, totally.
And I have no doubt, Emily, that if you take it seriously, you know, your paralegal program was probably no joke. If you take law school seriously, I have no doubt that you'll be able to graduate. And especially if your current firm is willing to employ you, 100% you should do this. I just want you to be really, really careful about how much you pay for it.
Yeah, because you said this is my dream and I'm willing to pay for happiness. Okay, whoa. My biggest worry is that Emily's going to be locked in her town, wherever that is,
yeah,
or feel locked in her town and decide to pay a lot of money for a local school that's unwilling to give her any sort of scholarship versus going to some other school that is, or even just raising your LSAT a few more points and opening up more doors at other schools that are willing to give you money.
Yeah, I'm worried that Emily's going to end up paying for misery if she does this the wrong way. If you end up at the wrong school paying the wrong price, Emily, like if you decide not to go to Campbell, but to go to like some slightly higher, you know, more prestigious school,
mm-hmm,
but now all of a sudden you're one of the very few people who are paying for the school to operate.
Yeah.
Because the same game happens at every level.
Yep.
We just want to make sure, Emily, that you're on the right side of that game.
Yeah.
So you should be looking, you know, like look at the scholarship estimator, look at the roll call tool, look at the 509 reports and educate yourself and be a sophisticated consumer when you decide what JD you actually want to purchase. And I just really hope that you pay the right price, because if you end up indebting yourself, you're just not going to get anything extra out of it that you weren't already going to get from a school that was going to give you a scholarship.
The wild takeaway for me from this discussion is that someone with a 2.98 and a 159 can get paid to go to law school.
Yeah, I mean, these are questionably reputable schools, right? Yeah. Like Golden Gate is one of the things that comes up in green. But yeah, I think if you try to apply to Golden Gate, they're going to say, yeah, actually, sorry, we're not taking any more new 1Ls because we're closing down.
Yeah.
Like, it's not that these law schools should exist. It's that they do exist. And how long can a school like Campbell continue to operate with those finances? I mean, there must be something to the story that we're not seeing.
Yeah, but Appalachian, which looks like a more sustainable model, who knows? I really shouldn't say anything about that particular school, but they're offering money, right? Like that's a better deal than Campbell, it seems like.
Oh yeah, I'm not telling her to go to Campbell specifically. Right. I mean, I should have said Appalachian there instead.
Yeah.
Like we would love it for you to go get a stock. That's the ultimate dream for Emily, right?
Yeah.
Because I don't think she has, I hope I'm right. Emily, you don't think you're going to go argue in front of the Supreme Court, right? You're not like thinking about changing policy and you want to practice the kind of law that you see lawyers practice every day, right? In your firm. If that's what you want to do, like if you've got your feet planted firmly on that ground, then you absolutely should go to law school and go get a scholarship somewhere, and you'll get all of the benefits that you think are coming to you. I think you'll probably get them because you know what you're bargaining for. My advice changes 100% the second you start saying, oh, well, no, I don't want to do that kind of law. Because then I'm like, well, okay, then now you're just like everybody else. Like, what do you want to do? And do you have fantasies about what you think law school is going to do for you versus like the reality of what real legal jobs actually look like? Last one is a success story from Jason. I'll let you read it.
Hello, Ben and Nathan. I have a 2.9 UGPA, that's undergraduate GPA, a 169 LSAT, and took the demon advice to apply broadly and applied to 25 schools.
Nice.
Wow, that's great. We don't usually give out specific numbers about applying broadly, but 25 certainly satisfies that condition. One of them, Texas A&M, waitlisted me in February after submitting early in the cycle. The scholarship estimator had predicted more than half. Since waitlisted applicants usually are not admitted, let alone given a scholarship, I did not attend any info sessions, interview, or write a letter of continued interest. A month later, I was surprisingly admitted and given a grant totaling $46,000 per year, making my total cost of attendance $3,000 per year. Maybe your total cost of tuition?
Maybe that's a stipend.
Maybe that's a stipend. Okay. Yeah, that would be great if total cost of attendance, which would include living expenses, is $3,000 per year. I then requested more and was granted a full scholarship. So it sounds like cost of attendance is just really tuition. This is the best full ride offer in the area where I want to live, and I accepted. Without this podcast and the demon, I would have applied last cycle very late with a bad LSAT and probably went to a bad law school and paid a lot. I first heard about the demon on Reddit, pre-shadow ban. So it's unfortunate people may miss out on all the great resources and advice. Praise the demon, Jason.
Yeah, on r/LSAT, you will not hear about LSAT demon because they have secretly banned us. Our reviews were too good.
Yep.
Jason is exactly, poster child for how to do it the right way. Bad grades, notice, you know, like
2.9.
And Emily, yeah. Emily above, 2.98 and a 159. But Emily, you could be Jason with 10 more LSAT points.
Yeah. You could be better than Jason with 10 more LSAT
points. You've got better grades than Jason. So what's up with the LSAT? Is 159 really the best that you can do? Because other people, they invest the time up front and effort up front to get the best LSAT they can, apply early, apply broadly like Jason. And the next thing you know, you're looking at, law school totally for free at a great school in a place where he wants to live.
Yeah. Amazing.
Interesting about the cycle this year being slower. It is true that in previous years, wait list is kind of the kiss of death, and there's not a lot of movement on the wait lists. You'll get waitlisted and then they'll just never talk to you again, which is crazy. Once school already starts, it's like,
yeah,
oh, I guess the wait list. I guess I didn't get a spot.
They never got back to me. Yep.
They didn't get back to me on that. Yeah. But here, Jason, they did get back to him. And that's without him doing anything else. He didn't write a letter of continued interest, even. No info session, no anything. It's just that they went through and waitlisted. He applied early, too. And then he got a February waitlist.
Wow. They're really like skittish, right? That just sounds... we're not sure what to do with this Supreme Court ruling.
Yeah. Well, also, it's like playing games with the applicants to see what they do.
Yep.
Right? Because if you just don't say anything, then whatever, maybe you're just making your decisions still. Jace doesn't say anything. So then they come back with not an admission, not an offer, not nothing. They actually come back with a little bit of an insult, kind of.
Yeah.
Oh, we'll waitlist you.
Mm-hmm.
Now see what you do.
See,
Jason didn't beg to get in. Yeah.
Yeah.
And then a month later, actually, here's our real offer.
Oh, we really do want you. We just couldn't
hold out any longer. But we're going to end up giving you a full ride.
Yeah.
Yeah. So that does look like, kind of a yield protection waitlist.
Mm-hmm.
And I agree with you, too, that, the admission cycle is just all wacky because schools haven't decided what's going to happen, how they're going to apply the Supreme Court decision about affirmative action. So it has been a weird, slower cycle, but we're starting to see some movement like this one here. Fantastic. Thanks for writing in. Anything more for Jason?
No, congrats.
Word of the week is from a book that Eric is reading. Eric, LSAT demon teacher Eric, podcast producer Eric. In addition to his calculus class that he's taking for fun, he also is reading a book, apparently. And I don't think this came from a calculus book. He found the word vituperate. Context is the coach vituperated at his failing athlete.
Okay, sounds like yelled or something like that. Scolded. That's my guess. But.
It could be it could be encouraged, it could be pleaded with, it could be, but yeah, I don't know, vituperate does sound.
It could be coaxed, right?
Could be like give a shoulder massage.
Berate. You know? Yeah.
Berate. No, it could be anything. It could actually be really anything. You know? What things might you do to a failing athlete? You could mock them or you could encourage them.
Mm-hmm.
You could marry them or you could shoot them. I mean, like, there's really not, you know, but okay. What does a coach do to his failing? The use of at makes me think that it's probably negative.
That's where I'm picking up on that. But
vituperated
Yeah.
It's like yelled at makes sense, but like, encouraged. Doesn't really make sense.
No, you talk with people you are on the same level. You talk at people who are below you, right? Or something. Yeah.
Yeah. And you like cheer for
up. Yeah. You cheer for, you encourage. Yeah. Okay.
But you might boo at
or
jeer at.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, anyway, let's see if we can get it from Merriam-Webster.
To abuse or censure severely or abusively, berate. So maybe rate is in there. I don't know if that's related or not, but.
Oh, because if I vituperate, berate, maybe. But Ben, you did, berate was one of your predictions that you tried to put in there.
Yeah, and I really just got that from the at and from the rate. So I don't know if it's actually related.
Yeah. It would fit with the context potentially. But yeah, to abuse or censure severely or abusively. So berate. Yeah. Vituperate at, really it should say yell there. Honestly. Is there any justification for using vituperated in that?
Nope. Sentence? It sounds like someone who's like, I know a word, I'm going to use it and fuck you all.
Yeah, what book is this? But I mean, who knows? Maybe it's some great, great book. I hope Eric's reading something good. But that does rankle a little bit. It's like, why did you really need to use that word right there? Because you could have just said yelled.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's wrap it up there. You can be LSAT famous. Please ask us questions or share news with us on our website, thinkinglsat.com, or on all the socials at LSAT Demon. If you have questions about the LSAT Demon, you can email the world's best customer service team. That's help@lsatdemon.com. Please check out our other podcast, LSAT Demon Daily. That was episode 451 of the Thinking LSAT podcast. Thanks all y'all for listening. Nice knowing you, and don't pay for law school.